the physical incarnation, you will see that such a person had to have one of these when it comes to this Kamarupa,
yes,
one of these forms, because it has lost its contact with the higher.
With the higher.
Mm-hmm. So I think if you take this asuras, I think it could be a medium.
Yes, very much so. Could him? That's right. Jim, right?
Would the Nirmana Kayas fit in the group too?
Oh no, 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 not at all.
Okay.
No. Robert. Yes, Robert.
Yeah. I think it's important to realize that the rupa, and especially the arupa, devas, are not laws or forces of nature in the ordinary sense of
yes.
Often use those words, which suggests something that is mm-hmm. impersonal.
Yes.
Because they are highly conscious, highly personal,
mm-hmm.
in ways that administer, you might say, the planet
mm-hmm.
In such a subtle manner that
mm-hmm.
it might appear to us to be simply impersonal laws of nature
mm-hmm.
in operation. But that
mm-hmm.
is really more the fact that we are working on mostly lower dimensions or
yes.
planes of reality
mm-hmm.
than that on which
mm-hmm.
we are.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, physicists now don't like talking about laws of nature anymore.
Yeah.
We talk about statistical probability quantum movements, which is significant because
uh-huh.
there's a real sense in which quantum do operate in a way that would seem to involve will and intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
They don't all go to the same place
yes.
the same way. They can jump around and so on. And
mm-hmm.
you know, somehow that seems to me like a sort of opening into the world of the devas and above all the arupa devas, the devas
yes.
which are working, you might say, in the implicate order and thus
mm-hmm.
very much out of sight and yet are,
mm-hmm.
are the, sort of behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yes, all right. So we've disposed of this seven groups, have we? Not easy, and you wonder really what Sinnott and Hume made of it. Of course, they had HVB to ask, heaven only knows what her answers were. But consequently, these in enumerating the seven lokas of the Kamaloka, the Avatamsaka Sutra gives us the seventh, the territory of doubt, and he asks Sinnott to remember the name, so we have to speak of it hereafter, and he does, he speaks of it, but not very much. Every such world within the sphere of effects has a Tathagata or Dian Choan, and it's very interesting that he uses the word Tathagata there, because generally that word is reserved for the Buddha, isn't it? But remember that the word Tathagata simply means one who has gone that way or one who has come. It depends on how you divide the word. Tathagata, to go, to travel. So either one has gone that way or one has come this way. It depends on which side of the river you're standing on, is whether it's one who has gone. So the Dhyan Chohan is of the Rupa and Aprupa Devas. Therefore, they are Tathagata. They have gone through this stage to protect and watch over, not to interfere with it. That's the interesting thing. They do not, because as having gone through this human, what we can call the human equilibrium there, the conscious stage, they cannot interfere. They're one with the very order of the universe. And so he says, of all men, spiritualists will be the first to reject and throw off our doctrines to the limbo of exploded superstitions. Were we to assure them that every one of their summer lands has seven boarding houses in it, the same number of spirit guides to boss in them, and call these angels St. Peter's, John's, and St. Ernest's. And Ernest, of course, was the guide of the spirit guide of Eglinton, remember? They would welcome us with open arms. But whoever heard of Tathags and Dhyan Chohans, Asuras, and Elementals? Preposterous. Still, we are happily allowed by our friends, Mr. Eglinton at least, to be possessed of a certain knowledge of occult sciences. And when he says, see Light, Light was the journal of the spiritualists in London. So, and then it's interesting, an unnumbered question, which in one sense is then question 9, or the answer is there any intermediate condition? And he says, alas, no, my friend, not that I know of. From Sukhavati down to the territory of doubt, there is a variety of spiritual states, but I'm not aware of any such intermediate state. So then he's told him even of Avicii, the hell from which there is no return, and quotes there one of the Abhidharma Shastras. Now, I think in the next paragraph, we come on the whole question. There is another kind of spirits we have lost sight of, the suicides and those killed by accident. And I think a lot of people are concerned over this word accident. Can there be accidents? Quite obviously, at one stage of the whole developmental, the whole evolutionary cycle, things can occur which were not really intended at that particular time. I've often thought that for the majority of humanity, for the vast majority of humanity, it really doesn't much matter what happens to us. Because everything is educative. So what may not have been intended in one sense, but does occur, is still part of the educational program for the soul, or the monad. And it really doesn't much matter whether you lose the physical and the whole incarnation at a particular stage, because it may not be within what we think of as the ripe karma of that stage, but it's all right, so to speak, because something is learned by the ego and the monad. And therefore, from that point of view, it's an accident, but from another point of view, it's part of the whole educational process. Does that make any sense? So, only as one progresses to the further reaches of spiritual growth, if I can put it that way, is it much more a need to balance the whole karmic consequences of action.
Your experiences are more deliberate.
Yes. But for the mass of us, and I include my, you know, I think all of us, you know, it really doesn't matter that much. Because I've come to be convinced that there probably are only a very few lessons that have to be learned to become a Buddha. But there are an infinite variety of ways in which we're taught. And because evolution indicates that we're slow learners, we get hit from one side and another until we finally learn that lesson. Maybe ultimately there's only one lesson to be learned, which is compassion and service. And I don't know. Meanwhile, you know, we are struggling on with the multitude of lessons. But it's sort of the thing that I think of, that things seem to happen to the same person over and over. And you feel, well, why did they learn that? You know. I often think of, and I use as an example, which is, bless her dear heart, a secretary I had when I was national president. And if anything was going to go wrong, anything was going to happen, it always seemed to happen to her, you know. And she would come into my office and I'd say, what's wrong now, Annie? What happened, you know? And it was always, you know, in an urgent letter that I wanted to get out, the ribbon would run out. And I said, well, just go and get another ribbon. But she said, why does it have to happen right now? You know, and it was always happening to her, you know. And you know, because it's almost the break, I'll tell you. You know, she was the kind of person, she took a flight from Chicago up to Minneapolis. Now that's how long a flight is that? About an hour, let's say about an hour, you know. And when it was on a holiday or a weekend or something to visit some friends. When she came back, she was stewing away. And I said, now what's happened? And she said, they didn't have my meal on board. And I said, but Annie, you didn't starve in an hour. So what, they didn't have it? But they were supposed to, they told me they'd have it. And I said, but you know, it doesn't really matter, does it? You know, and this was always... I think one of the things I'll never forget her coming in. We used to have a mail trip that went down to the post office at 12:30 precisely. I don't know what goes on at Alcott these days. Anyway, it used to be, and then it came back at 1:10 because we were supposed to be back in our offices at 1:15. This was back in the days when I made sure everybody was back at the time. When I ruled the roost there.
We need you.
Anyway, it was the days before we had a washer and dryer at the headquarters. So Annie stopped midway on the trip, and she put her laundry in the washer, you see. And she put the soap in, and she put her quarter in, 25-cent. Yeah, you see. And then she was going to pick it up on the way back from the trip. And, of course, she came back, and the thing was moving around and still regurgitating whatever it does in washers. And next to it was this washer with her laundry in it. And she had put the quarter in the... And so she was stewing, and it had wasted her whole noon hour. And I said, she said it wasn't marked clearly enough. So she'd put it in the wrong machine. And she said they should have a sign, you know, that says, this belongs to this machine. I said, but it's right there beside the machine. And she'd put it in the other machine, which was happily going on with nothing in it. But it was the fault of the machine. It was the fault of the people at the laundromat that it wasn't properly marked, you see. So I kept saying, Annie, you've got to learn. You know, you've got to really learn to pay attention. Now, look, just forget it. But this is...
Very eye-focused.
Yes, she was very, yes. Rosemary?
I wonder whose fault it was. When we all went to the convention in 75 in New York, yeah. She left her teeth.
And she left
her teeth behind.
Oh, my nerves.
Anyway, but I use it as an example, really, which is very unkind, because she was a wonderful secretary, I must say. She was the best secretary I had from the point of view. Not one word could anyone get out of her of what went on in my office, the national president's office. And I was always grateful, because, and her letters were beautiful, absolutely beautifully typed. Sometimes she didn't understand the word I used, so she'd make up a word. I say, where did that come from? But it was beautiful. It was a beautiful letter, perfectly typed, you know. But and she was a very good secretary from the point of view that I could trust her absolutely and with confidential things that went on in the president's office. So I was grateful for that. But I used to. So I always felt that there are some people to whom lessons come again and again, the same lesson. The same sort of thing. And probably that's true with many of us. All right, let's...
Groundhog Day.
And, yes, Groundhog Day is that movie. Yes, it happens over and over and over.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm?
I just said we try and keep it less public. We're getting the same...
That's right, we're trying. That's right. We don't want everybody to know. All right, let's take our break and come back. Is... undoubtedly a typographical error in this, and I think that while it's on my mind, you'd better make mention of it, Robert. That's
important.
It's in 85B, which is 24B in the third edition, and where it seems to be correct in the third edition, but it's in the chronological edition where. Undoubtedly, although it seems to me I've heard the word in Indian English, but I think it makes more sense. So it's on page 265.
In that first part, section 9, the third line from the bottom of that paragraph, the word Molemans. When I was reading through it, that kind of puzzled me, and being sort of interested in words, I had no idea what it meant, so I looked it up, couldn't even find it in the big unabridged dictionary that they have down in the library here, and John Aljo looked it up in the older edition, the so-called third edition, and found there that it's a different word, Melomans. What's that?
M-E-L-O-M-A-N.
Well, that's what it is here, but this is what is incorrect. In the older edition, it is melomane, which I think means a fanatic about music. M-E-L-O-M-A-N-N-E is how I think how they spell it there.
So the O and the E are transposed. So
yes.
And, it also has M-A-N-N-E on the end of it, and that I would have thought Maine would have just one N, but that is a pit.
Yes. So it's undoubtedly a typographical
error. Yes. What's the
correct spelling for it?
Mellow Man.
M-E-L-O.
M-A-N-N-E.
M-E.
That means fanatic for music.
And it means a fanatic about music?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Otherwise, yeah.
Mellow Man.
Do I think I've seen that?
Yes, yeah, in a sense, yes.
Yeah, one here in the index of the old edition, 185-86.
Well, the fanatic is a thing we don't agree with.
Yeah, well, that's true.
It's correct here.
Well, I got the second edition, and it's wrong in mine.
Hmm? Have you got yours?
What do you have in the...
M-E-L-O-M-A-N-S.
Well, in the third edition, it's M-E-L-O-M-A-N-E-S.
E-S.
Well,
yes.
Well,
the third edition, let me explain. The third edition was based on a complete study of the letters themselves in the British Museum Library. So there were many corrections from the second edition made in the third edition as they went through the letters again. Then the chronological edition was supposed to have been prepared from the third edition. But again, things can creep in.
I was going to mention, I've just noticed, looking at the index, that if you look at the facing page about the same place, slightly further down, it uses the word melomaniac.
Oh, yeah.
The melomaniac, italicized, knows of no higher state of bliss and happiness than music.
Yes, mm-hmm. So that makes
it
clear.
That it's the same word.
Yes, mm-hmm. So the... But that's the progression that was made. The first edition, the plates were destroyed in the Blitz. So then the second edition was prepared. The third edition was based on a complete study of the original letters all over again, and many things corrected. In fact, in the second edition, you find in one letter there are a lot of blanks, and those are now available. In the third edition, though, it was found they could really read the script, and so you can put
I have that stuff. I have, so.
And then, but the chronological edition was based on the third edition, clearly.
I don't know if there is if it is of any help, but in the Spanish edition, it says the word is melómano, which is a lover of melody.
Melody, mm-hmm. Yes. So that's
pretty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the and the Spanish was then prepared from the chronological.
It is said, and this is a translation at the beginning of the mm-hmm. third edition in English.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, that moment,
and the Finnish edition, I know, is based on the chronological edition.
Yes.
Because when I was in Finland, they had the Finnish edition.
I like the melody. So
it is, errors can creep in, typographical errors have a way of creeping in. Strange times. Well, coming back then in the time, I think it's useful to spend a little time on the matter of accidents and suicides. And notice the statement, both kinds can communicate and both have to pay dearly for such visits. So the advice, of course, is not to draw them back. As he says, it's a sin and cruelty to revive their memory and intensify their suffering by giving them a chance of living an artificial life. And probably that's what the elemental wants, is to have a kind of artificial life, so the medium draws it in. But notice, a chance to overload their karma, to increase the karmic responsibility.
Are we again on page 197?
197. Mm-hmm. So the suicides, of course, notice, having lost by the rash act their seventh and sixth principles, though not forever. So it would appear, as I interpret it, that for suicides, this death struggle does not take place. So that they do remain, rather than the death struggle where the sixth and seventh and the fourth and fifth are in conflict, and hopefully the sixth and seventh with the higher part of the fifth will win out. But in this, it would appear there is not that, for suicides, not that death struggle.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. That means that in case of suicide, it is treated, it works like a natural death.
It's not a natural death, you see. And
no,
that's what.
You said nothing happens.
Yes. Well, having lost by the rash act their seventh and sixth principles, though not forever, as they can regain both, they're often made to regret life and tempted to regain a hold upon it by sinful means, which would be through mediums. In the Kamaloka, the land of intense desires, they can gratify their earthly yearnings, but through a living proxy. And the living proxy, of course, would be a medium. And so at the expiration of the natural turn, if they do it in that way, they generally lose their monad forever. So the fate of the suicide is really a serious one.
Joy, it's interesting that this is really written from the point of view of the personality.
Mm-hmm.
The monad has lost that particular life
yeah.
and the advantages of it.
Yeah.
But because we tend to work from the personality.
But this level, says they lose their monad forever.
Yeah, but that's only the personality that's done that.
Yes, but they have done it through the medium. They've used this living proxy.
But isn't that true that from the, it's like any of the wasted lives?
Yes.
It doesn't mean that the monad is destroyed.
It no, the monad isn't destroyed.
There's nothing from that life.
That's right. Yes, and maybe that's what you were saying, Gavin, I take it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I think what Gavin is saying is that if you look at it from the point of view of the monad, you know, it's not such a serious thing. The monad says, well, I lost this particular vehicle, but I'll get another one, you know, and go on.
Yes.
And, so that's it is a matter of, you know, who's doing the talking.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Excuse me, Joy. Is it by committing suicide that they can lose their mind forever?
Yes.
Or because they try to...
Because they take on this artificial life through a living proxy, the medium.
So mainly because of this, but not because they committed suicide.
Yes, probably, yes, not because they committed suicide.
Okay.
So what I find, losing the money, I can understand quite well, but losing it, and then... But perhaps not forever is more interesting.
Yes.
How you could lose it and then...
Yes. Well, perhaps because in one sense, that same vibratory material vibrating and resonating in it the same, would be drawn together again. But it would be a new being in a sense, new personality.
Yeah. What it says here is instead of accepting their punishment, now it doesn't say what the punishment would be, but it's...
Living life.
Which would be regretting life and living out this horror of it.
Yeah, and so then that would give them back their 6 and 7%.
Yes.
Joy, would it be more correct to say that the monad discards...
Yes, the monad really says yes.
And that they do have another chance.
They have another chance.
Another monad.
Yes.
But in a more general sense.
Mm-hmm. But it certainly isn't a pleasant situation. And on the next page, then, and the next paragraph, you see, but if the victim of accident or violence be neither very good nor very bad, an average person, then this may happen to him. A medium, and I think this is something that we need to take note of, because we may be asked about suicides and so on. A medium who attracts him, this is the average person, will create for him the most undesirable of things, a new combination of skandhas and a new and evil karma. So again and again, Sinnott is warned against this whole thing of mediumship. Now, there's an interesting passage in letter number 76. This is letter 21 in the second and third edition. And it's, again, there's quite a... there's a letter first from Sinnott to... which refers to it on page 238. Notice Sinnott is taking this up as to the victim. You'll notice in Sinnott's letter, "My dear guardian," begins on page 238, and I suppose that's the same in the second, third edition. "As to the victims of suicide, of accident, these fare still worse, unhappy shades cut off in the full flush of earthly passions. They are the pisashas. They not only ruin their victims and so on." And the Mahatma has put in, again correct, "Bear in mind that the exceptions enforce the rule." And then Sinnott goes on, "And if they are neither very good nor very bad, the victims of accident or violence derive a new set of skandhas from the medium who attracts them." And he says, "I've explained the situation on the margin of proofs. And the proofs were of a work that Sinnott wrote called Letters on Theosophy. Then, after the conclusion of Sinnott's letter, which in this edition is page 239, accidents occur under the most various circumstances, and men are not only killed accidentally or die as suicides, but are also murdered, something we have not even touched upon. Well, the number of murders these days we ought to touch upon. I can well understand your perplexity, but can hardly help you. Bear always in mind that there are exceptions to every rule, and to these again and other side exceptions, and be always prepared to learn something new. I can easily understand we are accused of contradictions and inconsistencies, aye, even to writing one thing today and denying it tomorrow. What you were taught is the rule. Good and pure accidents sleep in the akasha, ignorant of their change. Now, in this case, akasha is sleeping in kamaloka, which again is composed of that fundamental substance, akasha. Very wicked and impure suffer all the tortures of a horrible nightmare. The majority, neither very good nor very bad, the victims of accident or violence, including murder, some sleep, others become nature pisachas. And when you go back to the pisachas, they're two principled ghosts, and so these are the, shall we say, they're naturally just the two principles are there, while a small minority may fall victims to mediums and derive a new set of skandhas from the medium who attracts them.
What does it cost the medium?
He doesn't go into that, but... when the medium, the karma of the medium must be something that has supply that.
Yes, I was going to suggest that in these passages, I think it's important to think a little bit about exactly how we define medium here. What is the medium that it's referring to? Particularly in line with what Lisa was suggesting earlier, that thinking of it in terms of contemporary relevance, because spiritualism is, it's not quite dead, but it certainly is not the force that it was in the 19th century, and it's probably pretty peripheral to most of our lives, but to only make spiritualist mediums in the technical sense of the word, the bad guys here, you know, I think is kind of marginalizing the whole thing. In many other places, we see that all sort of people can be mediums in relation to unpleasant spirits in the lower astral or kama plane and so on. That the people that are addicted to drugs and alcohol, for example, can certainly draw these spirits.
Absolutely.
That want to experience it vicariously through them. Yes. I'm sure they can, their ways in which they could lend their skandhas or even their whole lives beings to them, and sometimes do. These lower astral spirits can get into people in states of drug or intoxication, or even simply in sleep, or when you're allowing yourselves to be open to all kinds of course influences. So I think that all of us really can be mediums here if we allow ourselves to be. It's important to think about what mediumship here means when it's used in the negative way.
But I think what he's talking about too is what we often think of as the kind of channeler that just lays herself or himself open to anything.
Yeah. Well, certainly when we allow ourselves to be a channel is the more commonly used word today, but our medium, I think they're really the same thing.
Yes.
Certainly we open ourselves to these kind of entities,
these kind
of influences.
And I think that's the whole thing. And this is what...
I don't think that's the only situation in which we can open ourselves.
To the highest. Oh, very true.
Or to the lowest,
HPD has written a wonderful article on mediums.
Yes, yes.
It's very,
very clear, yes. And I think to a large extent it applies to these so-called channelers that are abounding today. Just another term for it, in a sense.
I just feel a little bit obligated to put in an opposite word here. I attended a trance medium for about 10 years between 1967 and 78, mm-hmm. 11 or 12 years, I guess. And it completely turned my life around for the better. Mm-hmm. This, no doubt, was an exception to what mm-hmm. you...
Yes, and as he says, there are exceptions, yes.
And mm-hmm. I know two very fine channelers today mm-hmm. Who bring through such illuminating entities that they'd knock your socks off mm-hmm. and you heard them. I'd sort of like to bring one here just for demonstration.
Yes, thank you. Yes, yes, thank you. I think that we just have to be very, very careful. And what are the criteria that we're going to use? And, you know, this is, of course, in many ways, this was directed, of course, to Sennett to wean him away from this reliance. And it arose out of who was this spirit guide of Stainton Moses. And indeed, sometimes the spirit guide, as he said, was one of the Mahatmas, was his own higher self. All of these are possible. But just to willy-nilly seek out a medium or a channeler, I think there are dangers. And we don't always know who is taking possession. Maria?
There's a paragraph that I come upon in my work for our little group. In letter number 15, it's page 44, where the master is talking about a certain individual and what he might do if he cultivated his own magnetic energy. And he says, his own powers would do the work and his own great experience be a sure guide for him. Mm-hmm. But he would have to guard against and avoid every foreign influence, especially those antagonistic to the nobler study of man as an integral Brahm, the microcosm, free and entirely independent of either the help or control of the invisible agencies, which the new dispensation, bombastic word, calls spirits. Mm-hmm. So I think this suggests something of the spirit of the would-be occultist,
yes.
who begins to come into a relationship with the powers of nature in all dimensions that is less dependent and unconscious and more healthy.
That's right. I think the way that we have been advised is to be very cautious mm-hmm. and to take responsibility for ourselves. This, of course, is the key. Be responsible. Take responsibility for your own development. Don't depend on others.
Joy, following on that particular statement you've just made, it's quite clear how important, karmically, a completed life is. Mm-hmm. And being cut off either by accident mm-hmm. or... precipitating the action yourself by suicide, mm-hmm. It affects, it's a result from the entire community. Mm-hmm. Accidents have to do with misjudgment. Mm-hmm. People being killed has to do with humans fighting and killing each other off. And suicides, perhaps a lack of compassion or concern for others, helps to bring it about. So it does show that... a complete life is a very important thing karmically mm-hmm. and probably affects the entire community much more than we realize. And it also brings up the question of assisted death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It does. It touches on all of these areas. Mm-hmm. But I come back to... thank you very much, Maria, because I think this is the important thing. If we are serious about leading a life that is... meaningful, purposeful, that is spiritually oriented, if you want to put it that way, that is really in line with the ideal of universal brotherhood in its broadest and fullest and most magnificent sense, then we take responsibility. And we do not give ourselves over to any kind of medium, good, bad, or indifferent. Any kind of external source.
How can we give ourselves to a medium?
But that's what happens.
I don't know what the medium is.
And so it seems to me this is the keynote of what is the theosophical mode. This is that we are responsible.
That's important.
Cecil?
Continue on this point. Also, I think this is the way I interpret what Robert said. If we're like sitting in a meeting, listening to a lecture, mm-hmm. and we're in kind of a passive mode, mm-hmm. not questioning what they're saying, then we're sort of like a medium.
Yes, yes. And this, I think, can be. And I think this is, I come back to the thing, one of the early statements, and certainly one of the keynotes that was struck by Colonel Olcott at the very inception of the society, and is given emphasis here in what an adept is the rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers. That's in one of the early first or second letter. We are to inquire, not just sit passively. We are to inquire, to really probe, which is what, to me, the study of the letters demands of us, is that we probe, that we seek, that we really, and we know what we're, try to know what we're about. So to me, there may be beautiful things coming through transmediums. That's up to you. But the theosophical ideal is very clearly set forth, and thank goodness it brought you to us.
Maybe what really counts is one's motivation and one's state of mind.
Of course, motive is everything.
And if you're motivated for the highest, mm-hmm. you receive the highest.
You will receive the highest. Thank you. Yes, very good. I'm glad you came to hear. It's been great. But it is true. Ultimately, we have to take responsibility. And no one else.
We just experienced the last 3 months two people we knew who committed suicide. They were fine people. In what way do we have responsibility that if they are so lonely, mm-hmm. or ill or whatever, mm-hmm. by neglect. Also,
and that too is karmic, isn't it? I mean, our karma in that mm-hmm. sense. Yes, very true. And I think we can do a great deal to help those who are, as it were, stuck in kamaloka by thoughts, by love, by, you know, that will.
Even thinking of them, even if they are far away.
That's right. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. So, something to be thought about, the whole matter. And certainly it does touch on this subject of assisted deaths. How do we answer that? It's a very serious, because this touches on all of these issues that are before humanity today and before us today. Very clearly, Martin?
Yes, on that respect, on helping, stand I remember up. Dora Kunz, one mm-hmm. time she said very briefly, when you do that, always on the higher self, never on the personality.
That's right.
Always send the best of you to the higher self.
To the higher self of that
no
person.
No form, no face,
yes.
Higher self.
That's right.
So that was interesting.
That's right.
this also brings in the question of the death, use of the death penalty.
Yes, it does, very much, capital punishment, which I think I don't know that every theosophist, but certainly the majority of us are opposed to, because what have you let loose into Kamaloka on the inner planes? What have we let loose? And often an elemental that takes up the weaker person and promotes their violence.
If I may, mm-hmm. What about the unconscious suicide of people who smoke, drink, eat sugar, mm-hmm. fast? Find unconsciously a way out doing that.
Yes.
And and they die maybe as 50, 60, 70, 80, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not a suicide if we do it unconsciously. It's not a suicide.
That's right. No, I think one of the lessons to me, at least, out of all of this is that we do inquire. We really have to have self-reliance. We simply have to be responsible for our acts and follow the path that we will, whatever. But we are. Well, I was going to get on, I'd hoped, to the very important paragraph that deals with the fact of studying the two doctrines, karma and nirvana, of Abhidharma. But really, there isn't much time to start that. But I think this is page 198, coming back. Not that we have exhausted all that has been said about accidents and suicides. There's very much more that has been said about it. Well, not a great deal more, but some other things that have been pointed out. But to me, one of the really key things to help us understand is this whole question of what is karma. And then it's very interesting to contrast it with nirvana, as it were, to put these two together. It's been suggested that, of course, the Abhidharma is a tremendous study, and I really don't know what might have been available, again, of the Abhidharma at the time of Sinnott's writing, all of that. The Abhidharma is known as, of course, the third of the baskets, so to speak, the Tipitaka, or baskets of the Buddhist teaching. It's the Buddhist canon contains, it said, three baskets. And the Vinaya is the rules for the order, the rules of discipline, which govern the community, the Sangha. And then we have the suttas or sutras, sutta in Pali, sutra in Sanskrit, which contains the dialogues or discourses of the Buddha. And then we have the Abhidhamma or Abhidharma in the Sanskrit, Pali Abhidhamma. Quite literally the higher teaching, the higher Dhamma. It's the third division of the canon in the Theravada or Southern school. And largely it's a commentary on the suttas or sutras, the sermons, and subjects them to analysis. But it's the psychological, I think, it's the psychological aspect. It's the mind training, very analytical, but it's always in... There's certain aspects to it that to me are extremely interesting. It deals with what arises in consciousness when consciousness is either wholesome or unwholesome, whether it's healthy or unhealthy. So that becomes its what we could call its karmic value, as it were. It has been suggested that in one of the manuals of Buddhist monism, the work of Arya Maitreya, known as the Uttara Tantra or the Ratnagotravabhaga, that which opens with the contents of the work, that perhaps these seven, you know, it said these karma and nirvana are but two of the double key to the metaphysics of Abhidharma, and so that there are seven, these are but two of the seven great mysteries of Buddhist metaphysics. So it's been suggested that the seven are given in the opening verse of this particular Uttara Tantra by Maitreya. The Buddha, which of course refers to the absolute, the aspect of the absolute, which is the often called the cosmical body, the Dharmakaya, the teaching. The doctrine then, the Buddha then is the form and then the teaching, the doctrine. The congregation, which means the totality of brotherhood, that is to say, to be in that wholesome state of mind in which there is a unitary perception or a relational perception based on unity, which is brotherhood. The germ of Buddhahood, which is the fundamental element, the essence, the background of the consciousness, which is there. Supreme enlightenment, which is nirvana, if you like. The attributes of the Buddha, and last of all, his acts. So you get seven then. The Buddha, the doctrine, the congregation, the germ of Buddhahood, supreme enlightenment, the attributes of the Buddha, and last of all, his acts, which would be then his the actions of the enlightened one. So when it says there's several sorts of karma, there is that which is, in that sense, karma-less, or karma-lessness, as it might be called.
Can you repeat the seven?
Yes. The Buddha, the doctrine, the congregation. This is this particular translation by Obermiller. The germ of Buddhahood, which is in the Sanskrit, the dhatu, dhatu, if you like, the essence, that is, the very essence of the supreme enlightenment, the attributes of the Buddha, which then are the incidentally, the marks of a Buddha, which is said to be 32 marks of a Buddha, corporeal marks. And last of all, his acts, which represent then that, which would represent his sermons perhaps, but also could represent the way in which he lives, the mode of being, which is without karma, with karma-less from that point of view.
What was the reference?
The reference is the Uttara Tantra, a translation. This is David Riegel supplied me with it, I must say, thanks to him, from the Acta Orientalia. It's a translation of the Uttara Tantra, the sublime science of the great vehicle to salvation, a manual of Buddhist monism, a work of Arya Maitreya with a commentary by Arya Sangha. And it was...
The Lord Maitreya?
Hmm? Mm-hmm.
Is that to do with the Lord Maitreya?
No, no. No, this is not with what we think of as the Lord Maitreya. But
yes.
Maitreya is a name. Maitreya. One of my very good friends at Adyar's name is Maitreya. Obermiller, O-B-E-R Miller, Obermiller. He translated from the Tibetan with introduction and notes by Obermiller. So it's interesting to at least ponder whether those are indeed the seven great mysteries. Well, they certainly are great mysteries, whether they're the seven great mysteries, but that's been suggested at least. And the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the Tathagarbha, that is to say the germ or the womb of the Tathagata, Bodhi, Guna, and Karma. We can summarize them that way. So very interesting to speculate, at least, whether these are the seven great mysteries. Certainly karma, nirvana, and then from karma, the Mahatma goes on then, suggesting that it's the cardinal tenet which brings about rebirth.
Cardinal what?
Tenet. This is there on page 198. Calls it that cardinal tenet, which teaches that as soon as any conscious or sentient being dies, a new being is produced, and he or it reappears in another birth on the same or another planet. When it uses planet, it's not in our solar system, but rather a globe in the planetary chain. So time doesn't permit us to get into that, but I'd like to take time. We still have three sessions. Some of our group will not be here, of course, but we still have three sessions next week, and I'd like to spend a little time on this, the Abhidharma, if that's all right with those who are going to be here, and we'll get into it. And at least perhaps consider some of these aspects and their bearing on our lives today.
The Mahatma Letters, Session 10.
We're still on Letter 68, and in some ways this seems a little bit anticlimactic after all of the events of last week to settle down, and we'll be into our final sessions of today, tomorrow, and Thursday are the final sessions. And quite obviously, we're not able to complete the entire study, but we will do what we can in the time that we have available. We had talked about victims of accident, suicide, and so on. Now, it's interesting that KH, I think, inserts at this point the fact that Sinnott ought to then really look seriously at two doctrines that are part of the Buddhist philosophy in the deeper sense, the Abhidharma. And this is probably the most impressive systemization of the whole of reality insofar as it concerns the human liberation from suffering and the way thereto. It is undoubtedly one of the deepest studies that one could engage in. But it deals with actuality, the Abhidharma, from an exclusively ethical and psychological point of view. And I think that is extremely interesting that this is put in at this stage in his studies, in the letters. Perhaps a hint to Sinnott, more than a hint, perhaps, to Sinnott, in an effort to get Sinnott to move away even further. There have been teachings, we had them in 18, and you have them in other letters, 44 and 45, 66, which we haven't looked at all. We looked a little bit at 44 in terms of the principles, you remember. But really to get Sinnott to really leave aside the interest in spiritualism and mediumistic communications and so on, to really try to understand in some sense two aspects which I think are really central in some ways to the whole theosophical system. First of all, ethics, a way of behaving, a mode of being. Not just the spiritual life, which of course is emphasized throughout the letters and the kind of life that should be lived, but just to be concerned with the values which lead to a genuine brotherhood. And when we say, therefore, an ethical viewpoint and a practical purpose, the practical purpose is, of course, to bring about this regenerative brotherhood, a practical regenerative brotherhood, which they speak of. And the Abhidharma focuses on that very much. But even more, it focuses on the psychological aspects of Buddhism. And I find that extremely interesting. The entire realm of consciousness. For two reasons. First of all, because as I think I've suggested, and the thing that I keep emphasizing in all my talks, I think, my lecture work, is that what is required is this complete transformation of the interior constitution. A complete transformation, which means a psychological transformation. Psychological in the sense of dealing with those central principles, fourth, fifth, and sixth, if you like, which, of course, are emphasized again. We've seen that in letter 44, 45, later on in later letters, and so on. And the fact that in the letters, the Mahatma says very clearly that at this stage, and this was perhaps why the emphasis here, at this stage, the chela, the disciple, the individual who is undergoing this transformation, is assailed completely on the psychological side of his nature. And it's rather interesting. The tests are all psychological in nature, which of course includes also, I would suggest, the discrimination between the illusory and the real and the unreal, to put it. It's a discrimination that is called for, which of course the center is at Manas, therefore discriminating between the real and the unreal, the illusory, that which is enduring and that which is illusory. And then also pointing to the fact that HPB clearly says, and I didn't bring the exact citation, which I should have. I get distracted looking up other things, and then I fail to get back. I'm sorry. Old age setting in. But HPB, you can look it up yourself, HPB says in Anthropogenesis that the next step, the next sense to be awakened, because there's a sense with each of the developmental stages, as we know. That's why we all have five physical senses at this stage. And the next sense to be developed, she says very clearly, has more to do with psychology than with physics. It's her statement. So here we have the Mahatma recommending that he could do nothing better than to study these two doctrines, karma and nirvana, which are, he says, the double key to the metaphysics of the Abhidharma, or Abhidhamma, as it is in the Pali. Yes. Yes, there are several very good. I meant to bring along. I have a manual of the Abhidharma, and there's a marvelous. There's several now available. There's a comprehensive manual of the Abhidharma. Most of these are published by the Buddhist Publication Society, and I'll bring my text tomorrow morning. I forgot to bring it today. I meant to put it in. I put in this other one instead. But you can get them through the Buddhist Publication Society. Most of these are, of course, in Sri Lanka, but I think they do have outlets in the United States and in probably other countries, too. Yes, one of the very best, in my opinion, one of the absolutely, for the Western student, is indeed The Psychological Attitude of Early Buddhist Philosophy by Lama Anagarika Govinda. The Psychological Attitude of Early Buddhist Philosophy.
My husband bought that. Lama Govinda was visiting New York Lodge.
What did you say?
Lama Govinda was visiting New York Lodge.
Yes, yes.
And my husband bought this book and asked Lama Govinda to sign it. And he said, this is difficult.
Yes, it is. It's not easy, but it's the easiest for Western students. I can tell you that, because I have several that deal with the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma studies, the one I have is Nyaponika Thera, T-H-E-R-A. Nyaponika is a monk in the manual of which I have of the Abhidhamma by Narada, N-A-R-A-D-A, Maha, M-A-H-A, Thera, T-H-E-R-A, Thera, of course, being indicating he's a monk. Again, the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka. There's another one published, which I also have, The Conception of Buddhist Nirvana, which is a wonderful one, by Theodore Cherbatsky. and that's published by one of the top publishing companies in India, Motilal Banarsidass.
What was his name again?
Theodore S-T-C-H, I mean, maybe I should put that on the board, Cherbatsky. A wonderful scholar. Russian, Theodore Cherbatsky. And that's published by Motilal Banarsidass, which is in Delhi. And I know that Wheaton used to get ship-in books from Motilal Banarsidass. Cherbatsky. Now, I thought I'd spend a little time on the Abhidharma because it is, as I say, it's a system of classifications. Tradition has it that the Abhidharma is the domain proper, the essential domain of the Buddhas. That these are the esoteric teachings in that sense. And that its initial conception of the Abhidharma arose initially in the Buddha's mind at the time immediately following his enlightenment. And as I say, it's the most comprehensive analysis of the states of consciousness. So it deals with the entire realm of consciousness, and it's said that it's the first time in the history of human thought that this was undertaken so thoroughly without any metaphysics and mythology, that it really is a study of thinking, because essentially, and in fact as Lama Govinda points out, it's not the world or the fact that everything is transitory that is the cause of suffering. The cause of this unsatisfactory condition, dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but Günther translates it unsatisfactoriness. It's the fact that the cause is ignorance. is a non-knowing condition. And so it's our attitude towards everything. And the moment we pause in any thought, there is a consequence. So this is the cause of avidya, the cause of everything arising. It's a veiling. Now, just to insert here as a kind of footnote, in the secret doctrine, the whole manifested system is a kind of cosmic breath. In fact, H.P.B. quotes a marvelous occult commentary it's the breathing out. Now that breathing out creates a veil that beyond which, and this comes back to what we saw in letter 18, incidentally. I hope I'm not jumping around too much, but you remember the statement in letter 18, and it's made elsewhere. It's in also letter 88, or the famous letter 10, if you prefer the old numbering, but 88, that we know nothing beyond, and even the highest adept cannot go beyond that veil of cosmic matter. Now, in the secret doctrine, that's called Mula Prakriti. And if you're familiar with Subbarao, who was, of course, an Advaita Vedantin, he speaks of Mula Prakriti as the veil over Parabrahma. Now, that veiling obscures, and that then brings a non-knowing condition. And all of that non-knowing, avidya, not knowing, not seeing clearly, because just as you can't see the mountains clearly this morning until that veil of fog lifts, so we can't see clearly until the veil or mist of non-knowing begins to disperse in consciousness. And so it is, therefore, it is this non-knowing that is our major problem. And consequently, once there is the non-knowing, there is all of the subsequent developments, as it were, which are, of course, called the nidanas. This is coming back to karma, then, as the twin keys, notice, the twin doctrine. So we have then, which is through the nidanas, which H.P.B. mentions in the very first stanza, the 12 causes of misery. The causes of misery were not, and the ways to bliss were not. They're essentially the same. Now, for these, the Mahatma, he gives it in a later letter. Actually, it's at the end of letter 88. If you have this book, it's on page 275. And he advises, this is also known as the chain of causation. Now, the nidanas, there are many different formulations of them. The word itself, nidana, is from two Sanskrit words, which means to bind down. So I think we should look at this, and we'll come back to because this is central to the Abhidharma. It simply means to bind down. Therefore, the bonds which form the causes for existence and produce the causes for rebirth, of course. So, as I say, in letter 88, it's a beautiful statement, page 275. Notice, read the Mahavagga, which is one of course, one of the sutras.
In the middle.
Right in the middle. Okay. Now, that's what we're going to read. At the time, and incidentally, let me pause there. At the time, this is not necessarily a moment, because the Abhidhamma always begins with the phrase, at a time when.
Once upon a time.
At a time when this occurs or that occurs. So the problem of time is a very interesting one. It implies a close connection between time and consciousness. So when the sutra begins, at the time, this is not necessarily, 10:25 on Tuesday morning sort of thing, but rather the moment following enlightenment, when all of the states of consciousness appeared in the Buddha's mind. So it is said. This is what tradition says. It's a beautiful concept of time. And so it implies not so much chronological time, but a number of other meanings. The Sanskrit word is samaya, S-A-M-A-Y, samaya. And it means a concurrence of circumstances. As though everything has come together, a concurrence of circumstances. A combination of modes of conditionality. It means the right moment. And I've often thought that in that connection it could be compared with what St. Paul calls kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S in the Greek. The right moment for something to occur.
Kairos. The Greek is kairos.
Yes, kairos. Yes. It's the momentary union of all of the components of consciousness. A constellation, as Jungian psychologists might call it, the constellation of events that brings it about. So at the time, the Blessed Buddha was at Uruvela on the shores of the river Naranyara as he rested under the Bodhi tree of wisdom after he had become some Buddha. This is beautiful, isn't it? And you see, it's not that he was sitting under this tree at a certain moment, but rather this is all the circumstances. He's achieved enlightenment, he's in meditation, he's at this, everything has come together for the rightness of it. At the end of the seventh day, again, symbolic, having his mind fixed on the chain of causation, and that's what this is. This is the chain of causation. Sometimes called the chain of dependent origination. You'll see that. Chain of dependent origination. He spake thus. And now he gives it. This is the chain. From ignorance, so ignorance, or avidya, if you want to. And that Pali is avidya. Sprang the samkaras of threefold nature. These are the accumulations. The samskaras, which are the Accumulations is another term for it. They're the formations, sometimes they're called the karmic formations. The form energies is the way Lama Govinda translates it. The karmic form energies. But I'll just use the term samskaras. They're the karmic resultants of action that come. And they, of course, are threefold. Body, speech, and thought. Now, speech is not just talking as I'm talking, but it's articulation of anything. You see, can I look at this without saying chair? So there's a mental articulation immediately. And this is the whole chain that HVB gives in the Secret Doctrine, which is one of the schools of Hinduism, of the whole development of from the original thought begins to take form, then this is the whole chain of Vach, V-A-C-H, and finally the external articulation. Body is body at any level, not just physical body, but any form, which is at all the form levels, and of course of thought, which is consciousness, mentation, rational understanding, and so on. So then, from the samskaras springs consciousness, or vijnana. So that's the third. I'm not going to get 12 down there. I'm writing too big. So that's discernment or consciousness. see how Lama Govinda translates it? Yes, spring. He just calls it consciousness. And dependence upon karmic form energies, the samskaras, consciousness. And dependence upon consciousness, and now the Buddha says, from consciousness springs name and form, nama-rupa. Name and form.
It's interesting that in this system, consciousness is not consciousness came first.
No.
It's more like a physical consciousness.
That's right. And but you see, but even in one sense, consciousness is first, but now this is more particularized consciousness. You see, because, of course, within even Mula Prakriti, there's consciousness, but it's unconsciousness. As HVB says, absolute consciousness is absolute unconsciousness.
From our point of view,
yes. So it's sort of like Fohat Jr. It's the more particularized. And so then arises name and form. And from this spring the six regions or the six senses. This is the six sense organs, the organs of sensation. Which is Ayatana, if you want the six organs of sensation. The seventh being but the property of but the enlightened. They're the organs of sensation. They're sometimes it's sala anyanta because the sixfold sense activity is the way Lama Govinda, the sixfold sense activity, but it's the organs of the senses. From these springs contact from this sensation, which is sparsa, or touch. You notice how carefully the Buddha is leading from, and it really is, it's as though one arising, all arise. You have to, although we put them in sequence, one arising, all arises. And so coming back to the Buddha, from these springs contact, from this sensation, from this springs thirst, Krishna, or Tanha. Thirst for continued sensation and continued existence and so on. So,
did you say this thirst?
From this?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. So, Krishna, thirst, tanha, craving, sometimes craving. In fact, this is the way that that Lama Govinda translates it, is craving, which is a thirst for sensation, a thirst for experience, a thirst for sensate existence, and so on. So he says, from this springs thirst, or desire, kama, tana. From thirst, attachment. And so then we have a clinging, upadana. Which is attachment.
George.
Yes?
You skipped number 7, which is sensation or vedana.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I did.
Those are 8 and 9.
I'm sorry. Yes. I was getting ahead of myself, wasn't it? Yes, vedana. Yes, sensation. Then Krishna. Yes. Sorry. Or attachment, thirst, clinging, and many tanha, Krishna. But here he's saying, and then upadana is 9. So he says, from thirst, attachment, upadana, and then existence, which is bhava, or becoming. Becoming, as we have svabhava, self-becoming, but existence. And then birth, bhava in the sense of causing to be born, old age and death, jara marana.
Has that taken all of those?
Old age and death.
Has that taken the birth, old age? Where does the birth come in? Does that take in?
This is rebirth then, oh, becoming.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And finally then, 12th. Well, no, then it's old age and death. No, it's grief, lamentation, and despair.
Rebirth is 11.
No, this is jati. Then it leads to jati, or rebirth.
Could you spell the one in 11 there for?
Jara Marana.
Jara, J-A-R-A-M-A-R-A-N-A. Jara Marana. So they're different translations, but now notice in the Buddha statement, jati is birth, being born on earth. Let me just read you Lama Govinda. He says, literally, the formula runs thus. In dependence upon ignorance, volition, that's samkara. In dependence upon karmic form energies, consciousness. In dependence upon consciousness, the psychophysical combination, which is Namarupa. In dependence upon the psychophysical combination, the sixfold sense activity, literally the six bases, salyatana. In dependence upon the sixfold sense activity, contact. In dependence upon contact, feeling. In dependence upon feeling, craving. In dependence upon craving, clinging. In dependence upon clinging, the process of becoming. In dependence upon the process of becoming, rebirth. In dependence upon rebirth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation. So sometimes these are switched around. You have other listings of them. So that the jati comes before the decay, jara marana. I was using a listing from the Secret Oral Teachings of Tibetan Text by Alexandra David Neal. So you can use different ones. But the point is that this is the chain of causation. And as Lama Govinda points out, since the entire series is to be thought of as a circle, every link...